All right, welcome back. Rhetoric Warriors slash rhetoric or persuasion, political persuasion training for America. Episode number 150. And
That's amazing.
this is episode 30 of David Payne.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm going to carve all these out as the Payne Chronicles.
Well, who knows? That at least there's a record, huh?
Yeah, right.
However
So,
obscure. There's a
yeah.
sci-fi story, some future individual finds these or something, right?
Well, think of how many lectures that you did over the years. None of those were ever captured or.
Right. It's probably at the same rate of redundancy here too.
Google now has a product, a software product where on Notebook LM, where you can upload just general text. And then it will turn it into a fake podcast episode.
Wow.
So it turns it into a conversation using the same content.
That's something. Have you watched one of these products? And
My roommate did one, show me one that she did yesterday, and I didn't get deeply into it. The only weird part, I mean, it sounded like a conversation. It sounded like two people having a conversation. The only
sure.
weird part was the back channeling was so obvious from the listener.
Right.
Wow. Okay. Huh. Well, that tell me more.
I see. So it invents the two characters themselves, and yeah, interesting. Well, it's that would be of interest to I think the Platonists and the conversation analysts to see what how AI simulated it. Yeah.
Oh my God, there's going to be so much, and the avatars are getting really good to where. You don't even have to do actual production anymore. You'll be able to just say, "Hey, I want put me in ancient Greece, my avatar of me in ancient Greece, talking to Aristotle, and take my content and his content and put together a 1 hour conversation between us."
That's interesting. I for in my basic rhetoric class for the teaching composition, I don't know if you remember the old PBS Steve Allen show, Meeting of the Minds, where he would invite Aristotle, Emily Dickinson, Genghis Khan, and Henry VIII to he'd have like five people, and people would wear the costume and come, and they would have a conversation about some topic. So I signed my students to do this with three individuals to kind of teach them. It was probably one of the better things I ever did because the results were amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I
Take on
think,
these voices and these points of view. So it was a way
yeah,
of teaching dialectic, basically.
yeah, for sure. And like, I just last week with a client was trying, they were trying to, they wanted a marketing client that they were doing a campaign that sort of had a Western theme. They sell like Western clothing. So it was something about a belt buckle. And they had done a blog post through AI for talking about the history of this belt buckle, where it came from and stuff. And it was kind of flat. And I'm like, well, rewrite it in the voice of Cormac McCarthy. Told AI to do that. And it instantly just added in all the kind of quirk and, adjectives. And then we did Larry McMurtry, Zane Grey, just to see which one came out more flavored. And it just kept taking the same content and adding different voice.
As treacherous as it would be, it warrants another reading of Baudrillard on the simulacrum, right?
Oh my
That
God.
we've passed through another layer of the political economy of simulations here. So,
Which brings us back to the topic
back
of
to, yeah,
today.
there you go. Brings us, of
This
course, it
is the
does.
episode on the rhetoric of lying, which seems to be, it's a tiny word, the lie, but it sort of lays down at the center of the railroad track of every potential problem in modern discourse. And Trump as the art of the lie, which is what his book should have been.
Furthermore, we are in a week where the reporting on lying per se is itself amplified. There's a new book out on the president's assault on the truth from the Washington Post fact checker. Interview and pretty interesting interview, sort of related to, from Thomas Snyder, the guy who wrote Yale prof who wrote On Tyranny and then On Freedom, on the fascist element of all of this and the role of what's going on in terms of the basic platform of fascism. So I'm inundated. Since we decided over a week ago to do this, I've been inundated with not just lying as a form of rhetoric, if that's even accurate, which I probably will deconstruct in a minute, but the actual talk about lying itself and what it means and how, why it should matter. Complete with positions out there, you know, that sort of say, well, no, it just really doesn't matter because it's whatever people believe. So we've also, as part of this bundle of meta lying, introduced a new kind of sophism where lying like killing somebody on Fifth Avenue should not matter, which is really not a new insight whatsoever.
Right.
Anyway, so it's really raised a whole lot of my classical rhetoric stuff with the sophists and Plato and.
Well, awesome. Yeah, pull all that up today because I start from sort of the polarities of on the mega, side of things and the meta side of things that, I did an essay or wrote a paper in James Canavy's class when I was at UT about on Nietzsche's truth and falsity in the ultra-moralistic sense, right? And so that starts with the premise that language itself is a metaphor, which is a lie, which, there's so much slippage inside of moving from referent to sign and all this stuff that never ever trust language because it's always going to lie, at least partially. So that's on the meta, big mega side of understanding language and slippage within language. And then down to this pico level where it's dialed in to very specific lies that you see politicians doing. And Trump is so, conscienceless, so sociopathic in how he lies that he just keeps stepping into bigger and bigger piles of lie dog poop. About they're eating the cats, they're eating the dogs, they're eating the pets. And that becomes a meme where now people are celebrating his lies because they're so extreme. But they're very pico lies and they try to track him. Trap him in each one and just jumps to the next one. He doesn't care. He just jumps around. So
He
anyway,
weaves them. He weaves them together.
those polarities to start with. Here's the ultimate liar, and his list of lies is long and distinguished. And here's, the fact that language itself is built, on deception.
Yeah. Well, it occurs to me that lying is, in a way, the norm. In other words, there's nothing new about lying. And to me, the what's causing people distress is that, the idea that lying doesn't matter—that these particular lies at that level don't matter—which is based on the assumption that pointing out that this is a lie is somehow disqualifying, which itself occurs in a, for want of any better frame, a dialectic of truth. Okay, so where did that come from? Where did that expectation come from? So
The
you know,
expectation that you should tell the truth.
well, sure, but we all know that. But we also live in a world inundated with advertising. So this is not irregular, right? Or once again, the level of dismissal when you know, the easy one that we've noted, I think, since the beginning of these podcasts. Oh, well, all politicians lie, therefore these lies don't count. That's at the most basic level, you know, that the expectation that there will be distortion. So is calling something a lie is a particular kind of speech act that is supposed to have meaning within a particular set of constructs about truth, right? Or truth telling. But you know, to sort of segue a minute, it occurs to me that when we talk about rhetoric, my agenda would be this is a perspective that's supposed to tell us something that show us something new, right? To reframe this in a way, and I think it has that value. And furthermore, for my agenda, as it's a history of ideas, that the idea of rhetoric has a particular kind of historical continuity through all of these different particular evolutions. So even from the big frame that you're talking about, where there is always slippage and distortion in signification, to there's always, you know, to the Nietzschean kind of existential anguish about that, to back to the sort of the Platonic. You know, this is all lying, and we, you know, this radical objectivity is what is the only thing that isn't lying. So, at any rate, there's a history to all of this. There are footprints of all of this. So, you know, in one sense, rhetoric is nothing but lying. I mean, this is, you know, so it's all lying. Even the great sophist Donald Trump, in his book about right the Art of the Deal talks about truthful hyperbole. He might as well be wearing a toga, right? Saying this is something. This hyperbole exaggerates. So he not only is he declaring himself when he was still making complete sentences and some sort of had some reflection of his place in the world. He was saying, "I'm a bullshit artist," basically, in a literal sort of acceptable way, which once again arcs us back to the sophistic, the anxious officers who say, "Well, this is kind of a special avenue to the truth to embellish and empower and to make it palatable and emotionalizing." So at any rate, it's only in to kind of maybe cut to the chase here. It's only in the expectation that there is an objectivity that. To call something a lie is one completely accurate. I mean, it's, we might have a more complex vocabulary for all the things that count now as lies. It's only with the expectation that we can get at truth, and that's an expectation, which is really a fairly recent idea, and seems to me to be part of the age of science and journalism and academic history. That to just simply dismiss something as a lie is sort of a, and it seems to me that right now we're living in a journalistic mode of talk, where this is my job, right? Because we have this myth of objectivity in journalism, which sort of says if we point out this is a lie, then automatically that should somehow be disqualifying, without really the complexity, of all the shades of gray of subjectivity, and the things that we use, so if you get back and look at in rhetoric, we've been trying to invent terms for all these shades of gray all along. Social truth, which strikes me as a bit ironic, given truth social, right? That there are myths, there are legends, there are things that are not perfectly true that we hold because that we collectivize around them. And this is one of the sophist answer to Plato, to say, okay, these are good. Some of these are good for us. Right.
Lives that are good for us.
Deceptions that we all engage in that make life better, more, this is humanism.
Let's hold on to that one for just a second,
Okay,
because I
go
think
for
that's a really strong way of looking at this that nobody ever uses. Like, I'm lying to you for your own good, right?
Sure.
Which is what we do with kids all the way through Santa Claus, all the way through. Like, the world is more magical if I lie to you,
Sure. Or more personal. Or we want to believe that human will can make a difference. There's a moral truth, right? And so the big defensive narrative modes, oh, there's a moral truth that's being conveyed here in a good story, right?
Well, and I'm trying to lift us up to go towards that goal. Like, it may not be true right now, but I'm lying about a good future that we can reach,
Sure.
so that it motivates us
Sure.
and coalesces around that goal.
And so we are aware, Parson Weems' George Washington, The Making of a President is basically an old book about how we had to spin a set of folklore in order to have somebody bigger than life that would collectivize, have the authority and capture the imagination and the sort of moral energy to be the leader, which, and there's no doubt that the leader is possessed of these things. And I think this is one of the reasons why we tend to excuse these little lies about the, our politicians passed along the way.
Well, do you think that's the underlying process that people have been trained to that's still echoing and supporting Trump is because everybody has been, especially Christians, who have been so, inundated in the idea of the good
Well,
hero,
I was
father,
getting around to that.
masculine
I mean,
father?
what yes, we do have a political mythology, right? George Washington was honest. The cherry tree is a made-up story. All of this, Abe Lincoln. If you look at the biographies of people, that's what they are. We have a political mythology. Just as a footnote and a sidelight, J.D. Vance calling for a new political religion. And what else is religion? And I think other scholars for years have noted that the political mythology is probably based on a religious model. So Getting back to the New Testament, sorry folks, there's a lot of, there's a lot of stories being told that create a myth, right? And religion has been a set of back to, you know, classic non-Christian myth. So mythology is part of this as well, right?
Well, to add a little comedy to the moment, which I always like to do when religion comes up, but I asked somebody once why Jesus couldn't fly, and they're like, "What do you mean?" I'm like, "Well, he's a superhero. He could walk on water. He could bring people back from the dead. Why didn't he just fly?" And they're like, "Well, that's ridiculous." I'm like, "Yeah, I know. The rest of it is perfectly rational."
Well, yeah, when you say how do people sustain lives, and then how many people are walking around from childhood on without being seriously able to question that Noah had a boat that two of every animal on the globe could actually get aboard for 40 days. I mean, think about it. So clearly there is
Well, and how
some.
many dead bodies was that boat bumping into for 40 days? Everything on Earth is dead. It's just like plowing.
I've never actually questioned that
It's
particular
just
problem.
plowing through all these dead people, floating everywhere.
So the point is that yes, we are trained mentally, intellectually, and in fact, we've only been trained to do this other objectivist, journalistic, scientific idea of truth far more recently, and we haven't ever really, as a group of people, learned to do it well. And
Yes,
so
absolutely true.
there is an educational divide. So this is really the default position of rhetoric and politics and myths, right?
Sure. Yeah, makes total
So the
sense.
question is, where did we get the idea that simply labeling something a lie was itself going to,
Well, it's
destabilize the
a,
entire apparatus that supports lying, which is as old as culture itself.
but it's a lie for, it's a wrongly motivated lie, right? It's a lie
Sure.
for an immoral purpose versus a lie for a moral purpose.
Yeah, this is no defense. This is no defense of the kind of crap that's being spun out here. This is
Now
not
I'm just
that.
trying to think of the distinctions of how you can, cleave that for people because everybody wants to stop. Like it always bothers me with the objectivity and subjectivity, debate. They're like, well, everything's subjective. And I'm like, yeah, but that doesn't mean all subjectivities are equal.
That's right.
Like there's a lot more going on here between this, opinion of this, guy sitting, in his truck stop in Alabama and this guy, who's a physicist. There's different subjectivity. And the same way, there's
Are
differing
shared,
lies,
yes.
and for us to at least have, like you said, kind of, you were suggesting like a lexicon of lying that we can train people to, so they can be a little more discerning about, oh, when Trump lies, it is different than when Biden lies. It is subjectively different.
Sure. Certainly in terms of almost every way there is to gauge a lie, intentionality, impact, what it's trying to, what is this truth trying to do, right?
Right.
And so that seems to me to be one of the questions that we need to be asking is what is this supposed to be doing? Rather than simply misinforming. I think misinformation and disinformation are themselves part of this, once again, this new lexicon that rely upon information itself having this status. That's only in a kind
Yeah,
of
it
a
has a very
journalistic world, right? You don't say, okay, this story about Hercules, this is misinformation. We recognize that there are tales out there. So why does one cling to, why is this an acceptable truth? So I think once again, the problem that we're really having here is why doesn't it matter? And secondly, what kinds of things do these truths do? And that explains at least to flash to, a recent dialogue about, well, these kinds of stories, this kind of lying, this kind of othering, creating mythology about a particular group of people, like immigrants, is itself, step two in basic fascism.
Well, you need easily beatable villains, right?
Right. Recently, we've been watching this it's Steven Spielberg, Tom Hanks thing on Pacific, the war in World War II, fighting the Japanese. And what's evident there is something we also saw in the Vietnam era, but the dehumanization of the Japanese, right? The kind of stereotyping that went on. This has been written out a great deal, that they were a fundamentally different kind of enemy that we didn't identify with as the way we did with Germans. even though that kind of went on with Germans too. So one thing that occurred to me is this kind of stereotyping, dehumanizing, vilifying, these are evil, savage, amoral agents. We did that with the American Indians, so that kind of
If you're going to kill
othering.
people, it helps to dehumanize them.
What's that?
If you're going to
Yes.
kill people, it helps to dehumanize them.
But these are also, they're, you know, one larger frame for this is groupthink, that these are ways of bolstering the mission, you're right, to do battle, but it evokes a war frame. That this is, we know that these aren't, things aren't true, but they're useful in a war frame of complete combat or vanquishing the enemy. Well, one thing it says to me is both in the case of Hitler's usage, but also Trump's, is that if you want to look for the frame that sustains these lies, it is warfare. And that is what they've been trying to justify violence. That this is a battle, this is a war, that people may have to be sacrificed to because of these
Well,
truths.
and think about that at the level of, weaponization, mass weaponization of lying, right? When you get into propaganda, and I think
Sure.
this is part of the thing with Trump, why, people, Americans aren't, they're not familiar with this particular modality of somebody who having that much power telling that many lies about this, vulnerable population. It's clearly a play that autocrats use, and Trump using it in the face of people's lived experience, like there is no mass chaos going on in America. There is no race rioting. There is none of this stuff going on. And he's still jamming, that technique, that tactic, right there in front of people on TV. And like it astounds the left. It astounds rationalists that it gets any traction at all. But he's not going to stop the tactic. And it doesn't matter what the content is, it keeps dropping in new contents every day. But that mass weaponization of lying is something I don't think we've seen, negative lying. Like you said, we've seen it in sort of positive lying about building mythologies and even our religion, things like that. But
Well,
we
even in
haven't
the
really
history of
seen it with
religion,
negative.
there's some bad moments, right?
Yeah.
The Inquisition is not positive one, but yeah.
But we haven't seen it in
But
America
it was similar.
about Americans. We've seen it, like you said, about Germans, about Japanese. We've seen people do that, in warfare, but like in peacetime, somebody using that technique, that tactic
The
against our own
minorities.
population to demonize segments of our own population is
Well,
pretty
the
new.
Irish and the Italians were both fairly well scourged. Certainly, there's been anti-Semitism in the United States. We're not, so I
But
think.
as a mass political thing, like on the national scale, have you ever seen, somebody running on these Irish are destroying the country, like in New York and sort of the immigrant populations centers, maybe. I just don't remember it as a national tactic.
Well, we don't remember it because, by the time we came around, those groups had assimilated basically because they're
Right.
white.
I guess McCarthy and the communists, they were doing that,
Sure, they're ideological and religious, right? Catholicism, for
Yeah, the
instance.
anti-Catholics in Kennedy,
So,
yeah.
in Ireland's over there fighting, war between Irish over Catholicism. So, these things, the history of division. I mean, let's face it. Part of what talk does in the political context is to create division. It is part of the dramatization. I mean, all of the, when Bret Baier asked Kamala Harris, why do half the people want to vote for Donald Trump? One answer, which was really a prejudicial, awful question, but one answer is because everything that we do, including what you're doing right now, is intended to create this kind of division. And these close elections have their own history. 1960, the year 2000, even 1980 was closer than people remember it. So more often than not, really, these things are much closer than having to do with anything to policy because the process itself. So there is something unusual about what we're doing, and there's something extreme about the kind of talk that we're creating to manufacture that division for sure. And something, dangerous about it. But I think if you scratch history very long, you're going to find all of this stuff going on. We just haven't storied it as part of our history, as part of our political mythology that rises
Well,
above this.
and I guess Nixon did it with the counterculture, and the youth, and they had
Absolutely.
these, yeah.
Absolutely. So
Absolutely. there's been
Now, this
a
play, this playbook is very old, and there's no doubt about that.
So tell me, like, if you were to school somebody how to counter what we're going to call negative line, as a rhetorician, advisor, consultant, I'm hiring you. And I'm like, hey, how do I counter all this, negative line coming from the GOP? What were some things that you would tell people?
Well, it's what an unfair thing to ask an academic. Understanding why it happens and doing anything about it. All right, this is
Yeah, I
fine.
know. That's I get it.
How does one counter it? Well, I think one the resources here are to find the bigger frame and then to allow that. And I think that's kind of the moment that we're at rhetorically with the campaign, with this current election. Is gee, is this really where you want to be slugging this out, or do you really, so can one adequately offer a transcendent? So how do you deal with conflict, right? Is there a unifying possibility here? And this itself may be instrumental in creating that unification. Aren't you just tired of this? I mean, is
Well,
this
it
a
was
productive frame? Is
interesting.
this going to generate the things that you really want in the
Right.
world?
Yeah, I think definitely the transcendent would apply. And if you look at the difference between Biden and Kamala Harris about how they did it, Biden did a lot of the sort of logos work of saying, hey, these are all lies, it's all misinformation, da, da, da. And he did a lot of that kind of rationality countering, but she went above it and did pathos countering with positivity, right? It's like, hey, don't you want a positive, life?
Well, yeah,
Like,
I mean, he was the empather in chief. So there was a definite kindness. There was a Christian kindness element, regard for others that transcends, as well as he's such a character right out of the last 50 years of secular political lore that so his bipartisanship, and I think that would, when they asked Kamala. Of course, I have all kinds of great answers for the questions that she gets asked because I have 3 days to think about them. But when they ask,
yeah.
what's the difference here? I think one difference is one thing I would do differently is that we wasted 2 years trying to do bipartisanship. Except one could also claim that that had certain kinds of good effects, depending on how you want to rewrite history. But so there are, I think that would be a difference. She's not using, bipartisanship as a secular political lore. She's trying to use the big tent, which is, we don't have to agree about these other things. Let's agree about this. So she's using a transcendent rhetoric that is not, we're going to still get to disagree about taxes and stuff, but
Well, she used ridicule too, during the
sure.
debate, just looking at him like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Well, I think that's why she has emotionally energized the Democrats in a way Biden probably did not. Right. That was kind of the thing found wanting, certainly by the progressives and the Biden. And I think that's why his support waned. I mean, it's remarkable to me as how unpopular he is, all things considered, because, from my more rational, except political pragmatist frame. Yeah, save the bacon here.
Well, I think, the other advantage that Harris had was that she hadn't absorbed, 4 straight years of lies. Like, they only
Right.
started lying about her, once she took on the nomination. Other than that, they ignored her completely. There's a little bit of border czar zings here and there. But now, since then, I mean, the lies that they've been pulling up is that, she never worked at McDonald's, which is kind of an interesting, odd PICO thing. She slept her way to the top of like all the insults, but the
Sure, but what
lies
did
that
what?
but they're not like, I mean, what became like just a massive swarm of lies around a candidate that's been attacked for 4 straight years like Biden was. She stepped right out of that hornet's nest, is like, hey, and they're like, oh no, we haven't lied about you very much yet.
Well, part of the othering against her has been more about her woman status, which I think cuts deeper. I mean, if you think about
But people know how to defend that
If
line.
we would, if we would, if we were getting rid of these characters in this particular story, Trump is all that he is, and Harris all that she is, and sort of say, well, we have the first black woman president, candidate running against the average Republican, you would still predict it to be a damn close race because many people just aren't there yet, right? I mean, we proved that with Hillary Clinton. I think if they hadn't ran Hillary, Trump would never have gotten elected.
Oh, I agree completely.
And a lot of that was just woman candidate, period. There is no woman leadership model. There is no way to be. So a lot of the othering of Kamala Harris is that, she's a woman. So she slept her way to the top. That one's powerful. And the next day came up, right? With a bogus story, right?
It is interesting though, like when we talk about rhetoricians in some mythical, ideal world, academic rhetoricians actually being used to help inform real life, rhetoric for good causes, that there at least has been training, like in the Me Too movement and things like that, for females of how to respond to, powerful liars. We do have some of those narratives. And like even last week or this week, Trump came out and was like, I couldn't believe that, Harvey Weinstein got schlonged, and literally pulling up, one of the biggest narratives within the Me Too movement while he's running against a woman and just totally unaware that that could be a thing. But like the Taylor Swift, all the sort of welling up all the feminism, we do have some history of how to defend against,
I think
anti-female
that's right,
liars.
and I think that's a nice way to put it, is that there is training about discounting that kind of talk. That there's analysis about what is that about. I can't help it. I can't re I refuse to say it, but I'm going to say it, right? Just like the Arnold Palmer thing is a whole new species, but it somehow is part of the same gender. And that dynamic's running, in the subcurrents of so much of this stuff.
You have to tell me your theory on this, because the blindness of the evangelicals thinking, hearing him talk about Arnold Palmer's Wang and then going, yeah, that's my guy. Like there being no dissonance allowed whatsoever. Is it just not, I mean, that is that impervious core of I'm not going to accept any dissonance whatsoever about this guy.
Yeah, well, boy, that's a nice challenge here, the essay test here. test your acumen. I guess I would start by sort of saying, evangelicals themselves exist along a spectrum of belief and commitment to belief and alignment of self with those beliefs. So I grew up with some evangelicals, and they could laugh at a smutty joke. They could be amused by somebody talking about the shower things. So that it's not like that isn't part of many of their lives. So I would look for a gender schism among the evangelicals themselves. And this is also kind of at the margins, because what is, evangelical? I mean, it's a terrible way to be talking. But they're not all Puritans, so we need to speak of this, right? Some of them speak about it as frequently as, or more frequently than you and I do, right? Certainly. I would say, one, we can't typify the way that they process their set of beliefs, or what are the core beliefs that make them choose this versus that. Just like among the Black community, there's the status of women is different, okay? That there's misogyny there. There's maybe a lack of preparedness for a female candidate, more so than in some parts of the white community. Among the evangelical community, there's a lot of gender patriarchy there. So, and you can go back and find a lot of it, of these supporters. So it's not like gender doesn't happen there. It just, it, so their relationship to a belief system is itself porous and shifting, and can be activated or deactivated. I guess the other part of that answer is compartmentalization. How do they compartmentalize politics itself? So, I mean, to begin with, the evangelicals really, I mean, this is a fairly recent phenomenon that they've even been activated politically at all. And it's a recent phenomenon that abortion is a political activation. This is something that didn't happen until the kind of the Jerry Falwell thing of the late 70s, post Roe, before abortion was, except for the Catholic Church, it was not a problem for the Southern Baptist Church. It was not a problem. So this is from this is itself part of a movement that. So once again, I guess the other bigger answer is that people are, fully full of contradictions, and that any ideology justifies these kinds of contradictions. So, long answer to
No,
short question, but.
I think I expect more dissonance from people than I get. That's the question, because a lot of it to me is dissonance games. Like, and I play this a lot in marketing too, with businesses, that you can't get people to buy things essentially unless they're in pain. That is the strongest driver of purchase behavior by far. I mean, there's the utopian desire to want things and enjoy things and all that, but it's really about, oh, my tooth hurts, I'm going to go to the dentist. And so
I would pay that money for that, yeah.
a lot of the business rhetoric is about getting people into more intense dissonance to make them feel the pain enough that they'll buy your product. And that maybe that's part of the lying
Well,
approach
but the
too.
storying of suffering is itself crucial to all of this rhetoric. It isn't just that we fail, but that you are suffering. Right? I mean, and Donald Trump's greatest commonality with that's the staggering thing is how do you see your interests aligned with this guy's interests? How do you see your experience? Is that he grieves so well, right? And he's adopted the topics of right the water cooler topics of explaining, our miseries to ourselves. So that's really what he's doing, and giving you a direction to remedy them. That's the sell, right?
Yeah, vote for me.
That's why the advertisement about one's toothache can do a great job of depicting the pain, but it directs you to the solution, even though it may be a perfectly inadequate one that costs a lot of money.
I have another question for you. What did you think about the consubstantiality play of Trump showing up at McDonald's? I am one of you. You are one of me. I'm just like,
I don't
it's.
know. It could be high level parody, right? I mean, since given the McDonald's thing, I'm a billionaire showing up. I want the job at the French fries. So in a way, the more incompetent he looked, because that was one of the critiques that came out was, well, gosh, he couldn't even scoop the French fries, or he's saying, gee, I didn't know they didn't do this with their hands. This would suggest to me that he may be eating McDonald's for the last 55 years, but he's never watched them scoop the French fries. It's really so.
My favorite part was them pulling out the Benito Mussolini in the wheat field photo op, which I never even knew about, but it was perfect. It was so,
I
him
haven't seen this.
shirtless. You gotta look it up, because it's him shirtless, and they basically, same thing, they cleared out a field of workers and took a bunch of pre-cut wheat, and he's got his rope tied, peasant pants on, and shirtless. And it's like what was the river that Mao said to, he swam shirtless. Same thing. It's like the virility of the leader, or the commonality of the
Sure.
leader. But
Putin with his tiger shirt or on the horseback shirtless.
just watching that guy stand there, and it was so memeable, like him standing there in that McDonald's uniform. They've just crushed him with memes ever since. If memes could win an election, mean memes, he would be out.
Well, I don't know if you've seen the AI generated one where Trump is working as a rescue worker in the flooding of Asheville, and he's got a rescuer outfit on. He's lost clearly 85 pounds, very, very bulked up with another bulky rescue worker wading through the water to help somebody. And of course, the commentary was, you know how this is fake is Donald Trump's helping somebody, right? That's how this is really a fake image. But it's clearly the same kind of thing. Yeah, those things are being pumped out, which are once again new creative ways of lying, right? And they are little bits of mythification, kind of
AI is the ultimate
the
liar,
Donald Trump rock video. I don't know.
right? I mean, isn't AI the ultimate liar? Like, it can literally mimic things that it did not create. It can, It can do all this stuff out of nowhere. It is a
Well, once
lie
again,
factor.
we need a politics of simulation. We need a rhetoric of simulation or whatever that sort of has, because clearly it can depict certain kinds of truths. It just how do we want to regard those? Clearly,
It's that the, I mean, that's one of the fundamental fears about AI, right? Is now we literally soon will not be able to discern at all between lies and truth, because the hyper real is now the real, and we've got a machine, that can do that. More so, like we've always had the, TV and film and, that kind of stuff and photography that can fake its way through things and words, but now this machine is going to merge all that stuff, and it's not going to take it very long to get to the point where you literally can't tell the difference in what, what's real and what isn't. So it's a new level of lying.
Right. Well, there is a parody out there of Joe Biden talking that with so it's an AI generated voice, and he's giving the kind of a Saturday Night Live speech about Kamala Harris, and at the end of it says, if you can't tell this is an AI generated a voice, then good luck with your senior year or something like that. So you're right, and people are talking about that. People are already having difficulty, right? And have had difficulty just with I knocked on doors, in 2008, I guess, and people saying, I got these emails, right? Email was for many populations relatively new. Emails about Obama being a Muslim. So, once again, back to misinformation. Yeah, it ups the ante there. Because these are seen as sources of information, just like
So
radio at one time was.
do the moral warriors have to spend their resources on sort of illuminating the lies, which is what I see a lot with the Democrats. They spend a lot of their energy, a lot of their capital, a lot of their screen time on illuminating lies, which means that the GOP is still winning because they're setting the agenda with the lies. And they do this to, Kamala Harris constantly. It's also may sum up in a online about, so when did journalism just become reading crazy tweets to politicians to get their take? Like, how is that a journalistic interview? And so, like, spending so much of your time responding to just this litany, unending litany of lies, that you don't get time to talk about your policies, and your policies now seem
Or
boring.
it fills up the news cycle in such a marvelous
Well,
way. And so once again,
and regular, logos heavy talk seems so boring in contrast to, well, he said he's eating they're eating the dogs and the cats. Let's talk about that for,
well, let's get back. Yeah, and that's kind of the most recent paradigm of the lie. Clearly untrue, testified to, has all the racist, agenda, which is kind of the it's sort of like a dirty joke. That's why we keep telling it, even though we know it's not true, because it embodies an attitude.
Well, like the couch, like J.D. Vance having sex with a couch. That was discredited as a lie. But man, that had a good 2 week cycle for
Well,
the
yeah,
Democrats.
I think that was more of the dirty joke than the
It was
racist
just
joke.
perfect. It was just perfect for that guy. It was the perfect lie about that guy.
It was nice. It certainly did have legs, but. Okay, once again, so a lot of our concern about lying was when Donald Trump looks at the camera, Trump repeats this bold-faced lie, and everybody says, okay, this is not true. This is not true. Why doesn't that push to reset here? And he get demerits for it. And what's his response? To double down and tell it some more. And even as late as like the day before yesterday, when confronted with that, say, well, what about the geese? What about the geese? So, anyway, so I think that's what we're trying to, it's what we're reeling from without a framework for explanation. It's why isn't saying lying, if this is a lie, enough? And what's their investment in keeping the lie going? Is that, what's going on there? Well,
Yeah,
I
it's
think
no longer a
if you want to
damning
look at the
indictment.
context,
Being a liar is no longer a damning indictment.
clearly not, at least there may be an art to it. There may be an art to it. It seems to me that you're right. It is the entire journalistic enterprise to continue to point this out. And it's and the level of frustration is, why isn't that enough? But if you look at the context for the next week following the election, we talked about that lie rather than the fact that Kamala Harris beat him in the debate. That was what all the micro analysis and attention and repetition was about. It was a perfect displacement of the real story.
Well, it's also, as you talk about it, like it says a lot about, since we are an entertainment-based culture now, that the power of fiction over fact, like running your politics and your political morality on your attachment and your allegiance to fact isn't as entertainingly interesting as somebody running a campaign based on fiction. Like, in fact, people sit around going, I'm kind of curious as to what Trump's going to say today, because he's
Sure.
just a fictionist. He'll just fit any fiction, any piece of dystopia, any absurdity. He doesn't care. Just feed him every day and he'll say it.
Sure. So, to what extent is the nightly news, or it's not even the nightly news? I probably very few people even watch that, but the whole industry of commentary and punditry and all of that that goes along with it, which we've observed quit being news, objective reading of the news years ago. So, to what extent is it, Federation wrestling, or we just have guys talking crap on each other, and that's entertainment? Why, to what extent is it just a soap opera, a day-to-day story? So this, once again, McDonald's takes its place just as a new little vignette, as like it was a sitcom.
New
You know,
episode, yeah.
think about the third, fourth, fifth seasons of any sitcom. These characters have quit being, in their own narrative. They're outside that narrative. And they're doing little vignette pieces that are interesting in and of themselves. So this is Donald Trump pretending to be work at McDonald's. How fun, right? More, it's sort of like the 11th season of
Well, it makes
Curb
a
Your
lot more
Enthusiasm.
sense to think, instead of what we try to do for so long of training the American population to the boredom of regular politics, to the factual boredom of regular political activity.
Well, one thing that we could say that it indicates is a depletion and a lack of energy around the older narrative, the one that would inspire us to go and feel patriotic and casting our vote and redeeming us as good people, voting for the system. Clearly, there's some corrosion there, if not complete collapse. And I think that's kind of maybe the thing that a good naming of our concern. Is what takes its place? Surely not this schlock. Surely
Right.
not, right? There
But
must be.
any entertainment oriented, fictional oriented, product, doesn't matter whether it's schlock or not, seems to have more traction than sort of gravitas, seriousness, dramatists, old school politics. Like, and I thought, there were times like when you saw Biden, when he had won, and he did a bunch of that kind of old school morality, political talks, political speeches, and he's good at it. He's been doing it for 50 years. And that kind of elevated everything back. I'm like, oh, I remember this politics. But he got
Right.
drugged instantly down, the Hunter Biden, drama, entertainment again. And lies go to the heart of fiction, right? I mean, it's all fiction is, even if it's discovering some universal truth through its art, it's still creating lies. And Trump has given himself permission to do that. Right, just completely give himself permission to be a fictionist. He doesn't care.
Right. This is the old 80s debate about postmodernism and the truth,
The
that
truth, the truth.
Trump can be a disruptor, Trump can introduce chaos, Trump can discredit the system, but what happens when the system disappears? So he can't be the system. There's got to be something to take its place. And that was, of course, Harris's first duty is, can you come up with a political mythology to surround to pull off the convention? Which she did pretty well, right? And one could look at the kind of storying and dramatizations that took place there, the way they, roll called the state. I mean, it was a pretty good spectacle. It's interesting, the Thomas Schneider tyranny guy detailing the steps of fascism Says here's a trait that Donald Trump has, and one of them is the preference for spectacle. So I think when we look at a lot of what he's done, that's part of it, right?
Well, and he had good, old school training from his days of trying to get attention as a New York promoter, and trying to get celebrity and all that stuff. So he had more, punch and deals and things like that, and raising money.
Well, I think the other possibility that I hope for is that he's too much the spectacle himself, and that some of this goes away with him.
I've said this many times that there's no other Trump. There's nobody waiting in the wings that brings all the assets together that he did. Like that sort of super exposure
Yes,
that he had.
and we just talked about a new economy of simulation. To what extent will both sides try to simulate some element of this now? How is that going to change the way we do politics? Because the last thing you said is, what's going to take, what how does one counter this? How does one, take advantage? What happens with both sides if you give up on this, journalistic political truth thing, and sort of say, what I have to do is come up with another a spectacle-based counter movement. What will that be like? And they may be two lesser versions opposing each other, but something's been tossed out along the way. An evolution has taken place. And it's interesting, as you have noted, that AI comes along at just the time
Right.
we need a myth machine, right?
Well, maybe that's it. Like Trump fades away, but now we've got AI Trump, and you can just vote for AI Trump. Like it doesn't have to be a real person,
Yeah, well, there people studying mass media. I think it was Jacques Ellul, really early on. That what is a media society? Guy Debord. This was the society of the spectacle, long before even television. We're seeing the propensities toward tyranny in a just a system of mass communication. That there is a technological center to this. So we could be playing this out. That kind of democracy just can't withstand this. I mean, so what will the new form of democracy really look like? One might be getting rid of the Electoral College, so the whole game board gets shifted here. I read a book many years ago about In Defense of Anarchy, where we do have the technology right now for direct immediate voting. We could vote on all the bills before Congress if we wanted to.
Yeah, right.
So get rid of all of that kind of representation, and let this just be
Man, talk about a persuasion free-for-all that
so
would be.
we've left into we've mutated into science fiction here,
Yeah,
but
but it's
there are long-term sorts of trajectories here that one might want to.
the states where they do direct issue ballots direct to the people. I was in California, and these things are constantly coming down. Vote yes on Prop 1, vote no on Prop 47. And nobody knows what the hell any of them say, because it's not been there's no education center for it, and it's so
It's
badly
true.
done. It's like
It's true.
it's I don't know, I think the technology angle is going to be really interesting because it does enable some wholly new ways of doing voting in politics.
Yeah, we don't trust the ballot and the machines at the ballot box. I'm not talking about myself, but enough people. Yet every one of those people has their credit card in their computer and their telephone and make online purchases. Right, where they do trust the system of encryption that, anyway. So, if you ask, can people trust that kind of technology? It's been planted, certainly.
It's funny too, like when you talk about go back to the idea of positive lying, as a professor, as a teacher, you kind of have to positive lie to your students, right? So many of them, you're like, yes, you can do this. Like you can, this is, you are capable of this. And that's, education has this lie kind of at its core that there's a generalized merit system, or merit, people are merit worthy to go through this kind of learning, and they can get there. I remember when I first taught at University of Louisville, coming from after I got my master's at UT Austin, and was your teaching assistant, Hart's teaching assistant. And I thought the students there were kind of, brain dead on their papers. And then I went to University of Louisville, and I had guys in class who were illiterate, and smart people. Like I had this guy, he went on to play in the NFL. He wrote, I had to write a paper, and I was like, you didn't write this. He's like, how do you know? I'm like, this doesn't sound like you at all. And he's like, yeah, that's not really my thing, writing and reading. I'm like, William, can you not read, buddy? And he's like, it's not my thing. And I'm like, God,
And why is college your thing? Yeah, I always felt very sorry for those people.
And I'm like, I get it, but you're smart enough to do this, but the like I said, the positive lie that you have to kind of walk around with, there's so much of this, and so the
Sure,
Pollyannaness,
motivation. Absolutely. And that is writ small, I think, in a microcosm, the same kind of motivational positivity that one brings to culture generally. That part of the political mythology function is to inspire us, to keep us headed toward positive goals, to tell us that we can overcome these problems or live with them. We know they're not going to get solved, right? And to give us a systematic way of, and in part the American system of having a revolution every 4 years where we draw, we divide and merge is part of that tolerance of where of accepting that things won't change. And this would be not news to the stock market guys. They're counting on there not being any dramatic change. This is so fundamentally, the economic structure of this country depends upon this not being a big upheaval in any particular kind of way,
What do you think
which
Trump
once
would?
again is a problem right now because what Trump is promising is a huge upheaval. And I think they just don't believe that he'll actually, get it. I can't think of any other reason to support it, but
Well, what do you think Trump would react to of saying like the lying for the common good? Like what you've always done is lying for the common good. Because Vance kind of said this at some point where he's like, yeah, well, if I have to make up stories to get people to pay attention to the horrible problem of immigration in
right.
Springfield, then I will do that.
Once again, I think we get back to needing
I
a
don't think Trump is doing lying for the common good. He's doing lying to get elected himself. That's it.
right. I think he would put that lipstick on. I think he would dress it up in those clothes. That these are vital lies, yes.
Vital lies.
Yeah, vital lies is an old category, sure.
Yeah, I love that. I always loved that book. I'm like, yeah, the vital lie, you're gonna be fine.
And there are sort of these humanistic deceptions, right? I mean, the comic frame is in and of itself. Great tragedy besets us. Random events set us at odds, but it always works out in the end, right? As opposed to the tragic frame, which is to set this right again, somebody's going to have to get sacrificed. In a way, those two big dramatic structures are governing a lot of how we stumble through this.
You ever ask anybody, because I sometimes bring this stuff back down. I love bringing it back down to the level of real people living real lives. And I'll ask, like when I do my show about adding more comedy into your marriages, into relationship. Like if you understand professionalized comedy, can you take those principles over and add them into a marriage and come out with a better marriage?
Dr. Phil, how's that working out for you?
It's great. I love doing that thing. But I'm like, one of the questions I ask is like, how much do you want your partner to be honest? And the first global reaction, especially from the females in the audience, is yes, absolutely. I'm like 100% honest. And they're like, yes. I'm like, okay, let's drill down into this. You do not want your, and we finally get to about 20% honesty, I think. It seems to be the equitable, like
20% is what you really want.
you can hand about that much and you're happy with 20%. The rest you just don't want to think about or talk about. But I'm like, do you want to hear your partner's accurate, unfiltered thoughts about you?
Oh, well, sure.
No, you do not.
And the happiest face you can put on that is that we sustain these duplicities constantly.
Constantly, because
I mean, there are the
they're
good
vital
feelings about one's
lies.
partner, and then there are the other ones.
Yeah, they'll do so much damage So many of the things that you think would do so much interpersonal
And I
good.
say that applies to the Trump voter and the evangelical, that we are expert at maintaining these schismogenic frames, only when push comes to shove or they're made to shove, and that's your dissonance model, right?
Right.
What in the system makes, only when the dissonance is so profound you can't sustain one of these frames, then does one have to add new information or reject other information? And I think that really is what's going on with the lying business, is we simply deprioritize that in favor of some better dissonance reducing. So, once again, the identity as a Republican, the identity as a conservative, the identity as a Democrat hating, liberal fearing, right? These identities get created, and that's a bigger frame than is Donald Trump really working at McDonald's, or even is Arnold Palmer really the man he says he is? So
Well, if you think about, the other lie that I think is circulating very strongly and is going to determine, they've tried to get it as a primary thing. I'm not sure it's the primary, how much determinant it is in people's choice making, but that Trump is driving things towards fascism, real anti-democracy. He will tear down many of the institutions and the protections if he gets another term. And that's a kind of truth that if they get established, and I've heard a lot of people, on Instagram, the Republicans who won't vote for Trump anymore, and they cite that rhetoric, right? And that so there's enough truth in it to them, and Trump saying things like, "I want to be a dictator on day one, and the enemy then," and all that kind of stuff, and trying to get people to think, "Oh, Donald Trump is telling the truth about that," versus he's lying about everything else, but that's his real truth. And so you get that weird dichotomy suddenly where the Democrats have to point out, oh, Donald Trump is telling, every once in a while he slips up and tells the truth about Project 2025, which nailed them because it was such a strong truth document about what their agenda was. And so holding them to truth here while damning them for all the lies here is a really weird dual rhetorical
Yeah, both
conundrum.
sides are, oh, he really isn't saying that, no matter how often confronted with the evidence of that. The same washing. He doesn't really mean that. He talks loose. We know that. Once again, that's and maybe that aggregate is kind of what is so corrosive about it, is that there's so few, and you're floating in this rapids through these historical events where stuff really does matter on these outcomes, and there's so few places to stand, right, to get a foothold.
Well, and the many layered burrito of lies, like you watched Mike Johnson coming out and they were pushing him, trap Tapper at him on the other day, pushing him, was like, "Hey, your candidate's talking about Walter or
Arnold Palmer, yes.
a golfer schlong here, and what do you think about that?" And he's like, "Well, I want to talk about policies." And it's like, yeah, well, your candidate is not talking about policies. And the guy's like, "Look, you can keep coming back to that, but I've answered it." So this is one of their tactics they're using recently is like they won't answer the question, and so the journalists will repeat the question to try to get the answer to this. I've already answered that. So they're lying about lying, so it's this folding in of,
Right,
this
and that's
layer of
where, to me,
lies.
that to me is where lying is useful. Why are you lying about that?
Yes.
Why are you lying about this instead of finding some better explanation or whatever? But psychologically, we call it dissociation. That if people are living in such dissonant circumstances, they can't reconcile the trauma with the day-to-day survival. They tend to dissociate, and in a way, there's. I think that's a lot of what's kind of going on, that we have a lot of media tools in sustaining those disassociations as well. High selectivity over what we're exposed to. Think about it. Trump or Fox News all by itself is a tool of that kind of dissociation. That it is part is itself a huge vehicle of the sanitization of this stuff. I mean, what's weird is that these agents continue to try to give Trump outs, and he won't take them.
Right.
And that's once again why you say, he really is telling the truth here. So the most awful part of this is really the truth. So once again, they're still working on the as agents on behalf of some sort of secular, political, rational process by saying, oh no, he really doesn't mean that. He really won't be doing that.
No, it seems pretty clear that there is an underlying truth agenda to some of that.
So
There's
yeah,
a
even tracking the role of lying in all of those layers, I think, is almost impossible. And maybe that is the upshot of this, is that it is so neutralized the industries of truth that one can no longer employ them. I guess the metaphor that you've been using, the fire hose of falsehoods, has that impact. It just smacks you against the wall every day. And whatever the industries of truth might be, and we Elizabeth Duncan had a moment yesterday. The Georgia Supreme Court smacked down the new rules about hand counting ballots, and anybody off the street can say, no, this we won't certify these ballots. Is that right now the courts seem to be the only environment in which truth still has a chance according to the rules,
Yeah. And then you see Trump wants to make Eileen Cannon from Florida, attorney general, and you're like, oh, yeah. I mean, they've always known this. Like,
well,
that's why
money, yes.
that's why Trump never goes on the stand ever, because he can't, there's no way he could survive, that much truth scrutiny, but it is interesting to watch how to. Is lying such a super unethical rhetoric that it can't be countered? Like it kind of feels that way, because it's no longer a damning indictment to just sort of hem people in, and you talk about disassociation. There's a lot of, the comedian interviewers who go to Trump rallies. The good liars are really good at it. And they did a post in the thing yesterday where they forced people in it. You can see the Trumper go into disassociation. So they totally locked them into a logic. It's like there was a superintendent schools, I think in Arizona, who was running, and she had said, we should execute Barack Obama and this other list of long people. And he asked them, this group of three ladies, he's like, do you think that disqualifies her? Is that somebody you want to vote for? And the woman was like, well, I'd have to, you don't really know what she meant by that. Like I'd have to hear it from her. He's like, well, you want to read another of her tweets? And the other tweet was, Barack Obama should be put in front of a firing squad and shot, not sent to prison because I don't want to pay another dime for his existence. And the woman was like, and he's like, well, what do you think about that? And she's like, she just froze and she walked away. And it was the
Well,
perfect,
that isn't a lie.
but it was a perfect moment of
That doesn't mean it's true.
disassociation. Yeah, perfect disassociation. And when you push them into that logical trap that where they can't get out of that mouse trap, and like, oh yeah, I'll just disassociate and just leave.
Sure. I 40 years ago, when we were talking about the politics of the image and trying to, images are not true or false, right? So when an advertisement presents you with a picture of something, it's neither true nor false. Truth and false are not the things to ask about it. Does it do this or does it do that is the only way to how does one feel about it, or how do you deal with your feelings about it? So I think once again we need to shift the way we regard these things and these stories. But I guess I had two kinds of inclinations as to your original question. That one is, how do you deal with that? James Carville, when he was Clinton's guy, basically, for one thing, I recommend just for esprit de corps reading his New York Times piece today, or yesterday about how he believes Harris will win. But when he was the honcho for the Clinton campaign, he said every one of these things is going to get answered, and I think that was a good. I would like to see that. That just sort of say, I have a, fact-checking group, and every day this is going to answer all of these things, and we're going to get it out there. The reason I say that is a good example is this most recent thing about I'm losing it now, the thread. All the advertisements run about Kamala Harris. supporting prisoners getting gender affirming
Right,
surgery
race time, sorry,
in
go ahead.
prison, right? Ran this for 3 or 4 days, or maybe for a solid week, constant on all the football channels. It's just constant. And so after a week, they come out, and the Lincoln Project has an ad about this now. After a full week of just being fire hosed with this one message, saying that was actually occurring under Donald Trump's presidency. And the clip from Kamala Harris supporting that as she was discussing that policy when Trump was president, and it was going, and they have the documentation. That truth almost doesn't even stand a chance now
Yeah,
after that
right.
barrage. Why wasn't this answered like instantly? Why wasn't it instantly, who's not doing their job? You can't really rely on the journalists clearly to do this. It took the Lincoln Project, and it took them a week to actually get a message out there, and that message is going to be very partial. So I yet think that that needs to be done. I think we need to accept that this kind of truth untruth thing needs to be like the Daily Show. It needs to be a morning show of you click in, and not everybody will watch, but hey, at least that information will get out there. But secondly, then what Harris also has had to do, and I see what she has done in the course of the campaign, is you have to retreat to larger truths. You have to let those things go and not answer them, or not get bogged down in them. But once again, she's been forced by the simple, brutal assault of that crap to retreat to a high level of truth. And now the campaign is, the final answer is here. Liz Cheney and I are on stage. We both
Yeah.
say, right, the big issue here is independent of all this stuff, you got to rise above all this stuff. So I think both functions have to occur. We have to change the dialectic here, where both things have to get done in the course of messaging. So that would be my two answers at opposite ends of.
Solid rhetorician answers, I think.
Well,
Solid.
we'll see. We'll see.
Well, I'll finish with this just because it's always fun when my worlds overlap. I don't know if I ever told you this story, but I got to sit with Carvel for an hour, just me
Yeah, you
and
did.
him,
Yeah. Go ahead.
because I was hired to punch up the Southern Sports Awards show, and I got flown to North to Charlotte to where they were filming this, and I was supposed to meet with all the talent and help them write their intros or their little banter, when they're giving out awards, and he was the host. And so I had an hour set aside with me and him where I was supposed to go through bits with him and help him punch things up. And he came in and sat down and we started talking. He's like, so what am I doing with you? And I'm like, I'm punching up your stuff, man. Like jokes, 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 jokes. He goes, yeah, I'll just do all that myself. And we just ended up talking for like an hour about, entertainment and talk shows and all that kind of stuff. But he was batshit crazy. He was funny.
I think he's one of the most credible political voices out there. But, and maybe it takes batshit crazy to do it. But
I think he used to be. I think he's kind of slipped. I think there's been some, dislodging over time. But yeah, man, during the Clinton years, he had it wired.
well, I've read a couple of his books. There's a new documentary out about him. I haven't seen yet, but I'm anxious to. But certainly his piece in the Times, where he says, "I don't do predictions, but I'm doing this one," is at least refreshing.
Yeah, make us feel good for another week and a half at least. Who knows what's gonna, what the world's gonna feel like in 10 days, but feel good as you can for the next 10 days. And whatever happens, we'll come back and throw some rhetoric at it. My God, I just can't imagine the difference in talking about rhetoric with another 4 years of Trump versus, oh, we finally escaped the Trump. We've
Well, that's
left
what we
the
didn't get into, the post-Trump, the post-truth, the post-rationalities
yeah.
of the,
It's a big orange shark out of the waters, hopefully.
yeah.
Let's see what happens. Well, thanks again. Always fun. Come back and see us again. We will keep talking here on the Rhetoric Warriors Political Persuasion Training for America podcast. See ya.
Bye now.